Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Pharma Marketing 411 podcast. We talk with the life science industry's most successful marketing professionals and gain insight on strategy and implementation from those who have made it happen. We'll have conversations that educate, inspire, and provide you with the tools you and your team can use to be successful. Our goal is to share valuable information that you can apply immediately to help your brands grow. PM 411 is brought to you by the Marketing Excellence Team at the Brooks Group. We are a learning and development firm that specializes in helping life science companies maximize marketing acumen, performance, and results. You can find the Brooks Group at thebrooksgrouponline.com. And now, get ready for the 411.
Welcome to part two of our conversation about pharmaceutical branding and trademarks. In episode 14, we had the pleasure of speaking with Jennifer Serup, Vice President of Trademarks at Addison Whitney, one of the premier global branding companies. During that episode, we talked a lot about the branding process and the goals for achieving a good proprietary name. During this episode, we want to delve further into developing pharmaceutical brand names and discuss more about the regulatory and the safety considerations. Jennifer, welcome to the podcast, and a special welcome to Nancy Globus, who is a Vice President of Regulatory and Medication Safety at Addison Whitney. Nancy, you are a pharmacist by training, so you bring a great perspective to this conversation. So thanks for joining us for this important discussion.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And welcome, Nancy, and thanks for being here for me as well. I'd like to start the episode by asking you a question about what you personally are focusing on from a regulatory and safety perspective during the brand name development process. You know, I asked Jennifer last time what her goals are related to developing trademarks, but let's take a look at this from the legal and regulatory perspective. When you meet with a client for the first time, what are you advising them to keep in the forefront of their thinking during the whole name development process, selection, and evaluation?
Well, the ultimate deliverable is, as we've talked about before with trademarks, is one that is legally available and ownable and able to be protected. But from a regulatory standpoint, the ultimate deliverable is whether or not that name is going to be accepted by the regulatory bodies such as FDA, EMA, Health Canada, et cetera. And regulatory approval is the what. But the why behind it is patient safety. And the regulators are in business to protect the public health. And if they believe that a name is misleading or confusing, then they are not going to approve that name. And so we just like to set the stage with having clients understand the why behind some of these stringent guidelines.
When do most companies, Nancy, when do most companies start thinking about developing a proprietary name for a drug? In other words, how far in advance should the process begin before, you know, a commercial launch?
Well, it's a good question. It's never too early to start thinking about branding, whether it's branding a clinical trial to raise awareness for a potential product, or branding the platform of a type of therapy. But for the product itself, it's typically several years in advance prior to launch, around phase two, the end of phase two trials, that process should get started. But then, especially with all of the new therapies that are coming out today, there are other circumstances that may come into play that would speed that up. For example, if there's a high medical unmet need, or something gets fast-tracked, or is an orphan product, things like that can certainly speed up the timeline for the need for a proprietary name. But it's definitely prudent to begin a couple of years prior to launch.
Excellent. So in probably late phase two, early phase three? Probably even earlier than that. Okay.
Yeah.
And you, as a follow-up, I got a couple follow-ups actually, but one of those follow-ups is you talked about branding a clinical trial. Is that, does that go through the similar process or is it a very different process?
As far from a creative and strategy process, it's going to be very similar. And I'm one to stay in my lane and I can't really speak to that necessarily, but it does not necessarily go through all of the rigors for confusion that a drug name would go through.
Right. Okay. And I also wanted to ask you, do you find that most companies adhere to best practices when it comes to timing, or as you said, you know, a couple years ahead of time, or do clients often wait to the last minute? And if they do, what sort of problems does that create?
Well, most companies do realize that the process does take time, and it's not always who files first, but who gets approved first. So even the best laid plans can get hijacked by somebody that perhaps jumps ahead in the approval process. And this is where I would love to hear from Jen. In some jurisdictions, it's trademark filing that drives the approval. And in other jurisdictions, such as in the US with FDA, the registration of a mark at the PTO does not necessarily guarantee that the name will be approved by the regulators.
Yeah, and I think, you know, different countries have different requirements in terms of trademarks. Like, for example, in the U.S., you have to show use or show intent to use, whereas other countries will allow a registration to go through. So, you know, it's a matter of determining whether or not something is actually out there in use and what the regulatory bodies look at in terms of, you know, what may or may potentially be problematic.
Yeah, and just to jump in, my question really then relates to the fact that the FDA really can decide, you know, who gets, based on the approval timing, who gets to use a certain name. And if a different name is close to that, you know, it may be disallowed. So at what point then do companies really initiate that FDA screening process for gaining the approval? And how early is too early? And when should they start thinking about that if we're worried about other companies, you know, jumping in front of them in the line?
Well, FDA and EMA both allow names to be submitted ahead of the full submission of the authorization application, whether it's the NDA or the MAA. So it can definitely, they can get an early read from those agencies, but it still is not a guarantee. So it's something that goes to planning for contingencies and having a couple of names in your back pocket in case some of those scenarios occur.
Yeah, and I know there's a number of tools that are available to companies and folks like yourselves and branding agencies to make use of. And the FDA even has a website that can be accessed to evaluate how close potential trademarks might be to other drugs. But one thing that may be missing for companies is the ability to perform an advanced evaluation of the medication error situation. So how do companies handle that? I mean, that seems to me like a situation that is ripe for the FDA coming in at the last minute and saying, I'm sorry, your drug name has potential for medication errors. And that creates that uh-oh scenario that, you know, companies then got to go to a backup, or even in a real bad situation, you know, go through the process all over again. So how does that come into play? Do companies do medication error screening on their own prior to submitting to the FDA, or how is that best handled?
It's best handled by experts, and I've spent about the last 20 years doing exactly that work very specifically. And you have to look at what the risk of confusion in the complex healthcare system could be, where in the drug use process an error could occur, and what the outcome of such an error would be, and then plow that knowledge back into the knowledge of how medication errors occur to assess the risk of a name. So we do all of that for the client as part of the process of creating, evaluating, and validating a name. And that's all part of the due diligence that goes into a potential recommendation. And then, you know, there's still, the regulators are still the regulators, and there's still some subjectivity to it. But it's the most due diligence that one can do.
And Nancy, just to expand on that a little bit further, and this is just a question that I have. So when the FDA is looking for the potential for medication errors, are they only looking at potential errors within the United States, or are they looking at a potential error that could occur, say, in Greece under a different trademark as well? How do they kind of adjudicate the global trademarks versus local jurisdictions?
They do take a little bit of a look ex-US, and there actually have been name changes that were based on errors that happened outside of the United States. And, you know, the world is flat anymore. People are traveling, and, well, maybe not so much now with the pandemic, but, you know, in a pre-pandemic world, people are traveling and you need your medication refilled, but the medication that you're taking in the United States may be one thing, but you're in Australia and that trade name is used for a completely different medication. So they do take a look, and we certainly look during the process for some of those near matches. And, you know, I don't think it goes necessarily through the, you know, they don't look into the depths of everything that's on the market in Greece and say, oh, well, we're not going to approve this because it's similar to something that's on the market in Greece. But there is definitely a consideration there. And again, it's all based in avoiding medication errors and keeping patients safe.
Yeah. I know there's a lot of careful considerations, a lot of due diligence done in all of this, but you know, occasionally a drug gets on the market and there's sort of that nightmare scenario where something happens, where your name maybe has to be retracted or a brand needs to be renamed. And that's, you know, a nightmare for a company certainly, and for everybody involved. Do you have examples of where that's happened, and sort of what's the process, when that happens, what's the process?
So certainly the granddaddy of them all that kind of started the name safety game in the U.S. was confusion when what was originally Losec is now Prilosec was introduced into the market in 1989. The brand name Losec was confused with Lasix. And further complicating that and allowing those errors to occur were the fact that both medications are available in the same dosage strengths and given the same number of times per day. So if you look at a prescription and you misinterpret that name, you know, we call it confirmation bias. There's no disconfirming evidence there. Like, oh, this is a topical cream, or, oh, this is 50 milligrams, not 40 milligrams, to, you know, to make that practitioner say, hey, wait a minute, I'm about to dispense the wrong thing. So those are the things that we look at. You know, does the dosage strength line up? Do the directions line up? Is it the same type of prescriber? You know, all of those, what we call non-name characteristics. And it ended up with the, you know, there were numerous medication error reports and ended up with the name being changed. In the United States, it's still available as Losec XUS. So that was an early one. There have been really only a handful over the years, but it truly is a nightmare scenario.
What do marketers need to do? What happens now? So to avoid that happening now, what policies or procedures came into place now that helps not for that not to happen again?
Well, the healthcare system is, you know, really super complex and can be unpredictable. So like I think of it as a vortex of, you know, you can do all the due diligence that you want to try to predict an error, but some of them are just not predictable because there are so many medication errors are multifactorial. There are so many reasons, many of which are way beyond the control of the marketer and the manufacturer. You know, they have no control over the setting and the practice issues that factor into a medication error. But from the things that the pharma companies do have control over, you know, I gave the example of Losec and Lasix. That was in the very early days. And in the intervening years, slowly but surely, some of the, you know, certainly the due diligence that the companies do and the regulatory guidances have evolved. It started in the early 2000s with the FDA holding several public meetings where they gathered feedback and eventually got written into guidances that were released as drafts. And eventually, just this past December of 2020, got finalized into a guidance for things that pharma companies need to keep in mind and branding agencies too when developing proprietary names for medications.
Yes, I mean, I cannot even imagine having to face one of those nightmare scenarios, but I also think about, you know, some successes along the way. So looking at it from the opposite perspective.
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe some names got through that were a little on the fence and questionable and maybe made the brand teams very happy. You know, I think of a name going back 25 years. This is maybe before some of these new perspectives and regulations went into place, but a drug like one called Acuneb, which is a nebulizing agent. Now, that name clearly points towards the accuracy of the dosing administration and then what the drug is actually doing, kind of the mechanism of action is a part of that name as well. That's got to be a huge win for the brand team. But that was a while ago. So let me ask a question in this way. Would that name get approved today for the same drug? And do you think, you know, what would count as a win today? So if you can't get a drug like that, you know, through the process, what are the wins that brand teams are looking for today that might be different than they were, say, 25 or 30 years ago?
I'll hit the second part of the question first. I think a win today is a name that is on message and on strategy that they can, with agency assistance, build a story around and to have something ownable and protectable that is approvable by the regulators that they could tell a good story to, that's a win. The first part of the question, would Acuneb get approved today? Probably not. And there are clauses in the FDA regulation that prevents product-specific attributes like NEB or TAB being embedded into a name. And again, there's reasoning for that, because let's say Acuneb comes out with an oral tablet. 2 years from now, well, then that name automatically becomes misleading because it says NIB, and that's indicating the wrong route of administration for an oral tablet. So there's reasoning behind it. And most of it is just, you know, it's overarching through all of the regulatory bodies throughout the world, no matter whether they have fixed guidances that they've made public or not. They want names to be understood, not prone to confusion that could lead to a medication error, and also not misleading or over-promising or over-promotional in any way. So, and that's, you know, that can be subjective. And, you know, from a U.S. perspective at the FDA, that's where the Office of Prescription Drug Promotion comes in and does their evaluation as well. And, you know, sometimes you scratch your head when names get approved and you're like, wow, how did that get approved?
Right.
And others, you know, yeah, we have clients that come to us that are like, my name got rejected. What do I do? And, you know, you're like, wow, that was the reasoning. You know, so there's still some subjectivity and not everything can be predicted. But, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And Jennifer, this is probably a good time to bring you into the conversation. So we have, you know, some criteria there that really define what a win for a brand team or a company would be. You know, it seems to me like as each stakeholder of the process, like yourself, you're responsible for the trademark, Nancy, you being responsible for the regulatory side and medication safety, and the company really wanting a great name for marketing, it seems to me at certain points of the process, you may have competing interests. Like the brand team certainly wants, you know, a marketable, memorable name that they can tell a story around. But what happens when that starts to fall apart? How do you manage that? How do you get to a process where at the end of the day, and maybe there's a fourth leg of the stool here, which is the actual FDA, how do you get to a name where everyone feels happy about that and nobody feels like they've compromised at all? Like what's the process for that?
I think we talked about that in the earlier version about the alignment of marketing and legal, and, you know, setting the correct expectations, understanding that, you know, to get excited about something until it goes through the legal and the regulatory process is challenging. We like to call that the triad: a legally viable name, a regulatorily acceptable name, and of course, what's preferential to the client team. And ultimately, you know, that is doable. It's just a matter of working through that process.
And it's really very consultative, you know, keeping in mind what time constraints a particular client may have, and also what their appetite may be to, if there is a rejection, to try and overturn a rejection, and also, you know, just in general, their risk tolerance. So,
yeah, and I guess just to follow up on that a little bit, you know, just from a trend standpoint, when you see somebody that does try to make an appeal and overturn a naming rejection, do you find that they're often successful, or do you find that a lot of clients just industry wide might say, well, it's not worth fighting it, I'm just going to go to my backup for the sake of time?
It's very dependent on the timing and how much more resources they want to put into it. I mean, we have a pretty good track record overturning rejections. I mean, you know, we'd like to avoid them in the first place, but sometimes they're not completely, you know, they can come out of the blue. Like I've said, not everything is predictable. And the client really has to have the time and the appetite to want to overturn it. I mean, there have been some rejections that, like, I felt like I could have driven a truck through the holes in their argument for why they rejected it. But in the end, the client didn't have time and just went to a backup.
Yeah. Nancy, I have a question for you. This relates a little bit to, I've got a couple questions. The first one is, this relates a little bit to what we were talking about earlier about different brand names, trademarks, and different countries around the world. Mm-hmm. And our listeners for this podcast come from about six different continents. So we have listeners from all over. And as they're thinking about, as a marketer is thinking about creating a name, is it preferable to have a global name or a country specific? How do you work through that? And what's your recommendation?
Well, most companies, it is preferable to have a global name, have the name the same in every country. And there are obviously lots of challenges there. You know, certainly I'm sure you talked about in the previous episode from the trademark perspective, trying to get something filed and owned in all those jurisdictions is challenging. And also, you have to keep in mind that there are different things, different products on the shelf, on pharmacy shelves in different countries. So what may cause a conflict in one country may not be an issue in another country because that product doesn't exist there. So, we certainly strive, if that is the client's perspective, is that they want a global name, we strive to get them there. But not being able to achieve that is not necessarily defeat, because there also are plenty of ways to tie together different names across jurisdictions. You know, I don't have to tell you, you're the marketers, visual branding, other branding elements that can tell that story authentically, even if the names are different in different jurisdictions.
Great. Thanks. And you know, in the last episode, we were talking to Jennifer about sort of tips. We like to leave our listeners with tips that they can like take away and start utilizing in their branding efforts. Mm-hmm. And so, just from your perspective, what are two or three sort of tips that you would like to share with marketers to help them know how to best get the outcome that is needed from a regulatory point of view?
I think one is to recognize the complexity of the healthcare system and realize that the underlying reason is, preventing medication errors and just realize what those underpinnings of the regulations are, and that there are different products in different countries. I know Jen mentioned this last time about loving your backups, and that is absolutely true, and planning for contingencies. And also like I said, that it's not necessarily defeat if you can't have the name you want in all jurisdictions, that you can still tell a good story, with the names that do get approved.
Nancy, those are great tips. Thank you so much for sharing. Nancy Globus, Vice President of Regulatory and Medication Safety, and Jen Syrup, Vice President of Trademarks at Addison Whitney. Thank you both for being on the Pharma Marketing 401 podcast.
It was great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
I know that our listeners will appreciate your insights about the key considerations when it comes to choosing and gaining approval for a drug's brand name, and we really appreciate your time.
Thank you to our listeners for tuning in to this special two-part series on pharma brand names. We hope you will download or stream upcoming episodes on your favorite podcast service like Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And we look forward to the next time when we will share more of the 411.
Thanks for listening to PM 411, brought to you by the Marketing Excellence team at the Brooks Group. If you are interested in appearing as a guest on the podcast, or if you would like more information on how we can help elevate your team's marketing effectiveness, we are interested in speaking with you. Email us at pm411@thebrooksgrouponline.com. That's pm411@thebrooksgrouponline.com. We'll see you next time with more 411.